You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So it's my great privilege to invite and introduce our next speakers. I did a course at university on religious studies, the end of the 80s. I remember one of the exam questions being, "God lives in a flower pot, discuss." And I was thinking about that as I did my preparation for this session and thinking, if I'd had the wisdom of the panel, maybe it might have answered the question a bit better. But here we have a very distinguished panel to help us think through the questions of psychedelics and God. Hunt Priest is going to be our compere and sort of interlocutor and conversationalist this afternoon. He heads up Ligare, and he'll talk, no doubt, a little bit about that this afternoon. It's a network who believe that Christianity and other religious traditions offer paths for experimenting mystical experiences for those, and those occasioned by sacred plants and compounds. So if you're looking forward to hearing what those sacred plants and compounds are, I'm sure you're going to hear about that. We're delighted to have Sugra Ahmed with us, social entrepreneur and consultant, and having previously worked with the universities of Birmingham, Yale, and Stanford. She's the founder and director of the community organisation Brilliant Burnley, and appointed last year to be the managing director of the Peterborough Cultural Alliance. So we're thrilled to have her with us. And right next to me here is Guy Hayward, who is, I love his website describes him as pilgrim, bounder and singer, director of the British Pilgrimage Trust, community advocating for the benefits and joys of pilgrimage. So however you've come this afternoon, we're delighted to have you here. We're delighted to have our panel, and give a huge pagoda welcome for Let's Get High, Psychedelics and God.
Wow, thank you all so much. This is such a beautiful opportunity. Before we begin, I do want to do a very informal poll, and if you would be willing to raise your hand, if you are surprised that there is an organization that is working at the intersection of Christianity and psychedelics. Raise your hand if that surprises you. Good. I'm glad you're here. As a way to ground us and bring us into the space, Guy is going to bless us with some music that's part of his work with the Pilgrimage Trust, and to bring us into the space together.
When the land whispers, "Don't be a stranger," that irresistible call to come home, to the wandering swear an allegiance, renew an old contract to roam. I felt in my heart a great yearning, leave a life so beholden to time. So I packed up my promise to face the uncertain, to attend to lost loves and landlines. 7 miles I will walk so uncertain, 7 miles I will walk in delight, 7 miles inconsolable mourning, 7 more unquestionably right. Some miles my heart will be empty, 7 miles I will rage and I'll cry, 7 miles I will crawl like a motherless baby, but the last mile I'll take to the sky. Let journeys outshine destinations, intuition outdestine our fears. Let blisters be teachers with blessings bestowed. Let the darkness restore us as seers. I'll make these pathways my companions, be witnessed by what cannot be seen, be peregrine, be pasture, be tiny, be vaster, be as soft as green moss, and be free.
Thank you, Guy. So we are going to leave time at the end for some questions. This is a large crowd, so we won't be able to take too many, but we do want this to be a conversation of sorts. And a reminder that our organization, Legare, does have a stall. What's that area called? In the takeaway area around the corner there. So please stop by, particularly if you're interested in going more deeply into the conversation, please stop by. It is disappointing that Dr. Watts is not able to join us. She is, if you don't know who she is, she's one of the world's leading psychedelic researchers. She's at Imperial College, and she had a neck injury that's kept her not able to do much these last few days, and she sends her regrets. And but if that name's not familiar to you, her website, Dr. Rosalind Watts, would be worth checking out. And again, she's at Imperial College. Our conversation is going to be primarily around the spiritual and religious use of psychedelics, but we're all here in a way because of the medical research and the psychological research that's been going on, at least for the last 20 years in the States and in Britain, around psychedelics and mental health. And I think most of us would agree that mental health and spiritual health are maybe the same thing, and if not, they're very aligned. And all three of us are here in various ways because of that research and the work that's being done in the clinical world on that. In regards to the clinical work, if this conversation is new to you, I would encourage you to do a little research with Imperial College's work, King's College, and then in the States, Johns Hopkins University, New York University, Michael Pollan's book and documentary, How to Change Your Mind, and Dr. Bill Richards, who's at Hopkins, his book, Sacred Knowledge. And that's all on our website. Right, just quickly, Bill Richards' book, Sacred Knowledge. And then Sebastian Gate, who is a Brit, lives in London, his Confessions of a Psychedelic Christian. Both of these are excellent reads and certainly pertinent to this conversation. So again, if this is all new to you, those would be good places to start. Before I begin a conversation around Christianity and psychedelics, I really always try to and want to acknowledge really the damage that the institutional church has done to these sacred plants. Indigenous communities around the world, and especially in the Americas, have used these sacred substances in their religious life for centuries, if not millennia. And during the colonial period, the institutional church beyond demonized. I mean, they had to go way underground. And for our benefit, in the 1950s, we began to rediscover their use and how they're helpful for people, both mainly for spiritual use. So again, the church is, we have a lot of complicity in that, and the generosity of indigenous communities to allow really a re-entree into that is a real gift. As a way to, for introductions, I'm going to ask all of us, and I'll start just to kind of model that and to do that first, is what brings each of us to this conversation around religion and spirituality and psychedelics? Just a quick introduction. So I'm an Anglican Episcopal priest in the United States. I'd been practicing my ministry for about 15 years, and I saw an ad in a magazine called The Christian Century that Johns Hopkins and New York University were looking for religious professionals from all traditions to be part of their research. They were doing mental health research, and they were discovering that the people that were having the most success for treating depression, anxiety, trauma, addiction, fear of dying, people that were having the most success were having profound religious and spiritual experiences. And so they brought in 25 religious professionals to use the same protocol. And I personally had if you know anything about the Anglican Church, and I know all of you do, a Pentecostal experience would be pretty unusual. And I had a very Pentecostal embodied experience of the Holy Spirit moving through my body twice, a month apart. And so I sat, and other things, but that was the core of it. And so I sat with that for about 5 years and trying to figure out how it was going to change and expand my ministry. I was a parish priest. And over those years, it came to me that there needed to be some mechanism to bring the medical research, the spiritual experience concept, back to Christian community, and to bring to the psychedelic community mystical and contemplative Christianity, which is so sort of unknown in most how people perceive Christianity. So it's a two-way conversation, and we do have a stall here, and we have a website, and we'll leave some information here for you in a minute if you're interested in that. But so that's how I got here. I'm going to ask Sugra to share her story about that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sugra Ahmed. I am not a Christian. I am Muslim, and one of the things I love about Greenbelt is that you'll find people from all sorts of different corners of not only this country but other parts of the globe. And this is my second time at Greenbelt, and I'm always, it feels like coming home. It really does. It's a beautiful, beautiful space. And see, now that is Greenbelt, isn't it? That's exactly what Greenbelt is like. There's just love and welcome everywhere. And I'm so, so glad that the weather has turned around, because it was a bit touch and go last night, I think. So I am born and raised in the UK. So my upbringing was sort of very typical, born in a Muslim household. Islam was kind of there. We went to the masjid in the evenings to learn how to read the Quran, so that when we're older, if we need it, if we want to lean on that as sort of spiritual, religious support, then that's a tool that we have, but didn't really understand much about it. And then 9/11 happened. I know a lot of people in this space won't remember that, because you're fortunately very young. But it happened, and I just graduated, and it kind of turned, it spinned my head a little bit. More than a little bit. And I decided that I didn't know too much about my faith, and I wanted to study it on my own terms, ask questions on my own terms. And so I went back to university, studied for a master's in Islamic studies, and then just basically spent years and years learning with scholars and religious leaders, and led a religious organization as my voluntary work. Some of you may have heard of the Islamic Society of Britain. I went on to lead that as an organization, starting in those early days as a volunteer. And it kind of, my curiosity and my thirst for religion, I think, stemmed from way back when I was a kid and my parents decided that they would send me to an Anglo-Catholic primary school. Can you imagine? I would go to mass in the church next door every Tuesday morning. I pleaded with my parents to give me a little note to say, she'll stay home. But they kept telling me that Jesus is important. He just means something different to you. But to be in the church and to be at one with other worshippers was important. And so I think the interfaith element in my life started well before I even understood what had happened, and I'm very grateful for it. So years later, I qualified as a Muslim chaplain. I went on to practice as a chaplain. I did a lot of work in policy, in academia. Religion just kept coming back. I think the fact that the government was so stuck for a while, I mean, still is, but so various governments have been stuck for a while on understanding British Muslim communities has also means that it keeps coming back in academia and policy circles, and therefore in my work. And so I find myself at Stanford University in California, an even longer story for another time, as Associate Dean for Religious Life. And a friend of mine calls me up and says there is a study that Hunt has just described. And I, after a little bit of a push and a pull spiritually, I decided that, yeah, I wanted my people to be at the table. I wanted women of color. I wanted Muslims. I wanted me at the table for that clinical trial. And it changed my life. So similarly, I had two doses a couple of months apart for me, and I encountered the divine in the most beautiful of ways. I felt like I shed several skins, and that was several years ago now, and I'm still learning and I'm still growing from it. So when this opportunity came, I mean, Ligara is a Christian psychedelic organization, but I hang on to the coattails. I'm on the WhatsApp group. I'm in touch with people by email. Hunt and I are very good friends. And so when I was asked, do you want to join? I jumped at the opportunity, and that's how I came here today.
Well, I was born into a family raised by two parents who were Christian scientists, which is not Scientology. It's a different kind of Christianity, but it's a sect that was created in the late 19th century by a lady, Mary Baker Eddy, and it's about healing and praying to God for healing. And I rejected that at around 12 years old, and I became a strong atheist, Dawkins loving, you know, science is everything kind of person, because I thought it made me cleverer. And then after going to university, and I started a PhD, so I was sort of clever apparently. And then I was having a bit of a problem, and there was some kind of something needed to change in my life, and I was unhappy. And then I had what some would call a spiritual awakening, or coming back to a faith in something much bigger than myself, and feeling part of that, rather than separate and an isolated being. So that happened, and I was about 24 when that happened. And then I still wasn't like putting a label to it. And then I started to come into contact with this scientist called Rupert Sheldrake, who basically said, "Guy, why don't you just, you know, get confirmed? Because it doesn't really close any doors. It just opens up your life." And I thought, yeah, okay. And then I went, and then I started to realize, yeah, to be anchored back into my roots and how I grew up felt good. It didn't feel bad anymore. It felt like the right thing. And a couple of years later, I found myself walking with this wandering minstrel around Britain, singing folk songs. And we had an amazing experience where we took a song back to where it came from, and actually the monument where all the people had died that the song was about, there was a couple standing by it, and we thought, what are you doing here? And they said, well, we've tried to find it 10 years ago. We're here for 5 minutes. And me and my wandering minstrel friend had been walking for 70 miles a whole week. So to arrive at this precise moment, they were just about to leave. We said, what's your connection to the tragedy? And they said, three of my ancestors died in the tragedy. And we're like, wow, that's a pretty amazing coincidence. And have you heard the song? And they hadn't heard the song, so we returned the song to the bloodline and not just the place. And I think in that moment we thought, well, what was this? This journey that we've just done had so much more meaning, so much more synchronicity, coincidence. And we thought, well, it's a bit like pilgrimage. And we had visited churches, and we were sort of tentatively going into them, not quite sure what to make of them. But then... I mean, I was a choir boy and sang in choir at Cambridge University with the choirs. So I'd been hundreds of thousands of church services. So it was a pretty familiar place to me, but I didn't feel necessarily totally part of it. Anyway, after this experience, we just thought, well, why is there no pilgrimage in Britain? And then we... Well, we found out that Henry VIII had banned it in 1538, and destroyed all of the places that used to house pilgrims, like the monasteries and stuff. So, and all the relics and stuff. So, it was an anti-Catholic move. Fair enough, you've got to do a rebrand. But the thing is, it destroyed pilgrimage. And so, we thought, why don't we bring it back in a more inclusive way that includes Christian pilgrimage and others, so that everyone can feel part of this. And then I suppose when I was 24, I did read an article about this ayahuasca church in Amazonia called Santo Daime. And it really intrigued me, and thought nothing of it for about 12 years. And then I think I'd gone through quite a lot. My mum had had a very serious, well, she had cancer, and my dad had open heart surgery, and my brother wasn't well. And I'd gone through quite a lot. And I think consciously, I don't know. I thought, okay, maybe someone said, why don't you come along to this thing? And I said, okay, I'll come along. And then that started to open up a whole world. Really brought me back to where I come from, and to really make me understand maybe what my parents had found so early on in their lives, and more, and exploring. So I'm still on that journey, and that's why I sang the song, you can find called Green Mossy Banks by Sam Lee, who gave us that song that we first took back to where that monument was. So I'm still on the journey, and hopefully this conversation will open up that journey.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Guy. Yeah.
So I talk to a lot of people about psychedelics and about Christianity. It's my job, and I do a lot of that. And what I often am discovering over the last 3 years for certain, as this organization has been up and running, is that people are either coming back to their faith because of a psychedelic experience, or maybe not even have been Christian, but have grown up in the West, so have the cultural Christianity and know who Jesus is or something, and are having an experience with psilocybin or some other psychedelic and becoming curious, or particularly in older generations, people that maybe had gone to college in the university in the 60s had experimented with LSD or some other compound. Many people went to seminary or sought ordination or found a way back into the church because of that experience. It's not really part of the narrative, but it's actually part of what's happened with people. So my next question for us and talking point is, how has your engagement with, I'll start with you, Sugra, how is your engagement with psychedelics, your part of this, your experiences in the study, made you a better Muslim, deepened your faith, made you a better human, maybe too.
I think the better human part first, because that's even though my encounters in my journeys were very, even so vivid that I can picture them and feel them right now. And so they were very real, they were true, there's definitely an authenticity within me that believes that that experience was real, and that is my, I came back to meet myself, that comes from within me. And I think at the time I, for various reasons, many trauma, the way that we are in Britain, I was quite closed. And if we were sort of like tactile or talked about love it was just be like very uncomfortable. And I think there's, like I said, a multiple range of reasons for that. And I think my encounters with the divine and my journeys really turned that on its head in a way that took me quite some time to really come to terms with, really understand, and allow it to unfold and allow it to become a more dominant part of my life. And so less head, basically, and more heart and gut and body, all of that good stuff. And then that affects your communication, it affects your relationships. It made me open to love, receiving and giving in a way that I didn't know was possible within me. And then I think for me came the spiritual side. I think first of all, I felt the change as a human being. I was just simply looking at the world very differently and couldn't quite understand that. But spiritually and theologically, I think I became, there was a little bit of frustration that I wasn't still committed in the way that I had been before to daily rituals of prayer, some kind of practice. I kind of just left it all. And I think it's because evolving as a human being was such an overwhelming event for me. And then when I did come back to, I wanted to come back to spiritual practice on my own terms. I didn't want to do it because I felt like I should do it. I wanted to do it because there was an inner calling. There was something in my heart, in my being, that was pulling me towards that, and I needed to answer that call. And it's a double-edged sword. It could go horribly wrong. But I was patient with it, and that ultimately has led me to a position where I feel very confident about my manifestation of my faith, my spirituality, my theological beliefs. I'm in deep relationship with God in a way that I don't think that I have been before, at least I don't remember. And I feel really proud of that. I feel really grateful for that. I feel very humbled by it. But I also feel really proud of it because I think, we all know faith, spirituality, belief, these are things that sort of, have this extraordinarily up and down effect. One day you can feel so incredibly closely connected to yourself and to the divine. And, another week it can feel like, well, what happened? How did I get so lost? And I think being more easy with that kind of process also has really helped me find truth in my relationship with God and find ways of communicating, thanking, and engaging that feel more like me and also true to Islam. And to be honest, prayer and all of these wonderful things, meditation, they're not that different in any of our faiths, really. So I feel a bit weird saying it like that, because it won't be that different from what some of you experience. But for me, it came from, rather than sort of a commitment to a ritual, it came from a commitment to my heart and a courage to wait for my heart to call and not feel abandoned when things went quiet. You know, I still kind of like feel a bit shaky even saying that, because it can feel really scary. But being patient and waiting, because God, it, to me, in my experience, was very, very close to me. And there's a verse in the Quran that says that God is closer to you than your jugular vein. So your life-giving source, that God is closer to you than that. And it, you know, it's one thing to experience it in your journey and be blessed with that kind of a gift. And it's a whole other thing to try and integrate that into your everyday life and to hold that dear, because it's enormous. It's really, really big. So to try and, for me to try and look for the small things was really important, because I was able to have building blocks that way. So whether it was a conversation with God periodically, whether it was a conversation with God throughout a whole day, you know, building up slowly like that, if it felt like it was a new way of being me, and also within the tradition that I was born into and that I'm committed to.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Sigrid. Very good. Guy, what about you? How has your engagement with psychedelics both made you a better human, deepened your faith, and or your own spiritual life?
I don't know how honest to be honest, like, because I mean, I've got this job as a charity director and stuff, so it's a bit tricky, but so my first ayahuasca experience, I suppose I connected with the bliss, a bliss that's available to all of us, and once you've experienced it, it's easier to access it, even when you're not necessarily under the influence of these things, although you always are in some way. The second time I came back to my body, this thing of coming back to your body is really really important, and it's a very subtle thing. It's not, there's the relationship I maybe had with my body was more like, you know, come on, let's do this thing called life, and you're here to support me, and let's just, you know, get on with it. But the changed relationship with the body is more like a friend that you need to work with, and it's like a collaborator, and sometimes it's not ready to get you to the next place that you want to go, and you have to listen to it, and really the body is talking to you and all the time. And this is not a psychedelic thing to say that, you know, the body is giving you signals all the time. And it's whether you listen and actually act on that, and give, if you're tired, then just give yourself time to be tired. You know, if your leg hurts in a particular way and it's worrying you, look into it. You know, actually spend some time, maybe hold, like, love it with your hands, put your hands on it. Like, it's more of a kind of, you're kind of mothering yourself, so that you don't need a woman to do that for you, especially if you're a man. And that kind of relationship is a big change. And I think it relates to the way we've been brought up in the West, with the Protestant Reformation largely being a kind of, Erasmus, who was the underpinning philosophy of it, was a slightly disembodied figure, a bit like Stephen Hawking, who maybe didn't have a totally strong connection with body, who knows, but he was really arguing for moving towards the mind, the word, the Bible, the intellectual side. And I think that led to a wonderful expansion that we are all benefit of. But it also, maybe especially with the banning of pilgrimage and the sensory side of religion, maybe it sort of it made something to do with the body like taboo or something. There's something you shouldn't really connect with. It's something a bit dirty about it. And I think that is changing. We see it with yoga, with the healthy foods and not eating processed food and all this kind of stuff. This change, we're starting to wise up to it now. So that was one thing. Then in terms of religious experiences, I mean, the things actually Sugra said about coming into your heart as well. There's a link between your body and your heart. But basically, if you're riding a bicycle, the kind of general thrust of the movement, let's say, is your heart, and your mind is just like stabilizers. That's this image I got, that my mind is just there to do the checking of the facts and the figures, just to check that the heart's right. But basically, the heart goes first, and you lead by your heart, and then you use your mind. The mind doesn't have control, and it shouldn't have control. And I think that is a much more freeing way of living. It will connect you with your intuition as much more. Mm. So it's a religious experience. I had a very interesting one where I saw the Holy Trinity of mothers, rather than Father, Son, Holy Spirit. It was three mother figures, and that was really interesting. Not sure what to make of it, but it was definitely real and extraordinary. Another one was, I'd always had a problem with the he, him, father, all this male stuff, especially in our context, the context of today, not quite understanding the masculine, you know, seeing the distorted masculine maybe in many ways around the world. And I actually met God the Father, and it was an amazing experience. I was one of the most moving experiences of my life, and the message I got there was, and by the way, I'm aware that this is not going to be like easy. This is not necessarily, I don't understand what this means, okay? Like, stuff happens you don't understand, and this is one of them. One which is, there is only one direction. That's the message of God the Father that I had. And this, I can only talk from my own experience, and I still don't understand what that means. It's slightly scary, you know, as a phrase. It sounds quite dogmatic, and we're trying to move beyond dogma in this world. But anyway, I just thought I'd say it. You know, we're talking about our experiences. That's it, you know. Other things, I saw the light. One of my experiences, I felt like my body had disintegrated, like dissolved, and I was going towards the light of heaven, and it was the most beautiful thing and most loving thing that I've ever seen. And I burst into tears, and I was crying for 45 minutes at least, and it was total bliss state. And I thought I was dying, but then when I eventually I came back, and it was normal life again. And but it was a different life. I suddenly felt like I didn't fear death anymore. I mean, obviously I don't want to die, but like if I were to die, I wouldn't be scared of it, because where we're going is pretty incredible. So and I don't know whether I actually felt it, because who knows, but like I feel less fear now. And there's a sort of that sense of reassurance of like, it's all going to be okay. Where it's all okay, everything is okay, no matter how bad your life seems to be. Ultimately, the ultimate reality is okay, and that is really helpful. That sort of learning to surrender to the divine, to God, to allow him just to take over, and not feel you have to understand everything that's happening in life, especially if things are not going well for you. You're like, why is it not going well? And then you just say, well, I don't know. Maybe there's a much higher purpose for it not going well. And that release is really important. I mean, you can go on and on and on. I mean, basically it's like going to a school, you have these courses, you have like a lesson one, you've got to learn this, lesson two, you've got to learn that. It's a little bit like that, except it's a bespoke training course for you as a person. So you learn one lesson one, and then you learn another lesson two, and then you think, oh yeah, I needed to do lesson one in order to understand the two, and it just goes on like that. So that's why it's a journey, and it's a longer journey. And yeah, I mean, maybe I'll continue forever, maybe I'll stop, you know. At some point it may just say, you know, now you've done enough, now just go and live sober or whatever it is. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm just open to that and to the journey. I mean, so much more to say, but I'm going to stop there, because that's where my mind is telling me to stop. Or my heart is telling me to stop, rather.
That's great. As I was thinking about Guy, about the panel, I was aware of his work, and I don't want to make too much of it, but I also don't want to sort of point it out that two of the ways that people talk about psychedelic experiences are tripping. That's one of the ways we talk about it. And then journeying. That's another way, that maybe a little bit more polite way to talk about the experience. And I think about the Christian, or the, that's not, it's not, pilgrimage is not Christian, the religious I mean, the Muslims really have us, really have that one down, that the idea that pilgrimage is, can be a profound spiritual and religious experience. And the fact that that's the language that we use in the culture around psychedelic experiences is just very interesting to me and a connecting point. A little bit about my own experience and how it's affected me as a human, as a priest, and as a Christian. So, like Guy, this is something we connected on earlier today too, was I was so here, and most of us are. These bodies are just a way to carry our computers around in a way. And I went to seminary and ordained because I'd had very powerful spiritual experiences in the world and in church as a child, as a late. So I had those experiences, and I think deep down wanted that to be my work, to help other people have those experiences in the world and in church. I'd had it at the communion rail. I'd had it at baptisms, other people's baptisms, and then I became a religious professional, and in a shrinking institution of the Christian church. And I went right to my head, to analytical, what book do I need to read? What program do we need to bring into the church? What music do we need to be using to get more people into the pews, which is really about institutional maintenance mostly, sadly. That's what a lot of that is about. So then I show up. I've been doing that for 12 years. I show up at Hopkins for the study, not really for spirit. I was just curious. I couldn't believe that people at Johns Hopkins cared anything about what religious professionals thought. I was intrigued. I'd had some background in mental health as a spiritual endeavor and work. And so I was just curious and wanted to have an experience. I hadn't had one before. And an hour and a half in, it's a longer story, but an hour and a half in, I began to feel an electrical current moving from the base of my spine right here. And it got stuck. And I now know about chakras and throat chakras and root chakras. I didn't at the time know much about that. And this electrical current was moving through my spine and got stuck right here. And I literally thought my Adam's apple was going to explode, or that whatever that was going to get out somehow. And my guide, we have two guides in that protocol, laid hands on me, on my shoulder, when another person went to my feet, and instantly that electrical current went up 1,000%, came out through my throat chakra, out the top of my head, and I think I was speaking in tongues. I was making sounds that I didn't recognize, and my whole body was electrified in a way that I'd never, ever, ever experienced before. And not in the moment, but upon reflection, it gave me an incredible understanding of the very familiar line from Scripture that our bodies are a temple of the Holy Spirit. And that's often used to talk you out of smoking and drinking and having sex. That's a misuse, friends, of that idea. And to Guy's point, the body is where God lives in the world. And we need our intellect, but we're embodied spirits, and we need to remember that. And it changed my ministry. It made me realize that insight, which was big, but also that everything we talk about in church, often as a priest and preacher like this, everything, it's all true. It's all true. We don't actually really understand how true it is. At least I didn't. I believed in the church, I believed in the liturgy, I believed in the word, but I didn't have it, this is like Guy, a little embarrassed to say, but I was off, and I was just kind of going through the motions in a way. And so my ministry after that changed in ways. When I laid hands on people in prayer, I realized that we were transferring energy, and on a crown chakra. And it just, even saying that now, I've kind of tear up. It's like, there's so much power in our religion. There's so much power in these traditions that we're just not accessing. And that's literal power. It's an electrical current in my body it took that. And so for me, and this will be the last thing I'll say about that, but for me, the Enneagram was helpful because as a 9, I knew I was disconnected from my body, and to have that powerful experience in my body was huge. Basil van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, was significant when I read that after the experience. And then Matthew Fox's book on the chakras, Original Blessing, I can't quite recall the name, but it's a thick book. It's on the chakras and the seven deadly sins, which he reframes as blessing. The throat chakra, he connects each of the seven chakras to the seven sacraments of the church. The connection for the throat chakra is the sacrament of ordination, which is really leadership. It's not about the priesthood. It's about, or the ordained ministry. It's about leadership and community. And my throat chakra was so blocked as a preacher. And it really changed my ministry. And it made me a better human and a better priest in ways that were very connected to my Christian life and practice. I do want to really throw in quickly, and not insignificantly, that these substances are not for everyone. There needs to be discernment about that. Again, a gift of religious traditions is about discernment. Spiritual direction. I've been in spiritual direction for 20 years. I've been a meditator, often not very committed, but I've been a meditator. So I think I brought to bear the preparation I'd done for a lot of my life brought me to a moment of, I think, a profound experience. So spiritual direction, I think, is very important for Christians to think about that as a way to discern whether or not, and then for integration and meaning making, spiritual direction can be very, very helpful. I'm wondering, so take a little break on that. But these are not scary, but they're powerful. And anything that's powerful needs some discernment around it.
Well, they are scary.
That's true. They are scary.
They are. I mean, they are scary. Like, it's, but the fear is just the mind talking.
Yeah, thank you.
And
yeah.
Actually, when you, one of the things is they teach you to do, which is the basis of all religion, is to surrender to a power much greater than you and just to let go. And that's really hard for us to do. But the more we try and control the experience once we're in it, you're stuffed. If you try and do that, you're stuffed. So, like, the fear is real, and you shouldn't think you're weird if you feel fear. It's very normal. It's healthy, in fact. You should really have some fear, because this stuff is not to be taken lightly. But the fear shouldn't last forever. You know, it's just there to help you to the next stage.
Yeah, thank you.
I think one of the things that I'd like to add to that is that set and setting and preparation are absolutely critical to the kind of experience that you'll have. And so if somebody does decide to do this, of course, in a legal way, somebody does decide to do this, then it's really, really important that there's a build-up, there's a preparation to it, that you're in conversation, in communication with people who can support you, who can help you, maybe even the people who will hold you, who will facilitate, who will guide you through the actual journey itself. And then, so there's a during, and then there's a post. And that integration is absolutely fundamental to enabling you to really make the most of what you've prepared for, undergone, and now to integrate that in your life means that your life will be moving in a direction that is true to what your own truth is, the truth that you encountered. But all of that, the early prep, it's not just chit-chat, it's actual sort of tools that you're building, that if you encounter something, an emotion, a feeling, a vision, that just feels like you cannot get past this, neither for love nor money, and your guides are not really that well equipped because you've not had the conversations to make sure that they are, that you can get stuck. And to get stuck is, I mean, it's just, after everything that you're hearing, you can imagine, to get stuck is awful. It's a tragedy. It's a travesty. And so it's really, really important that the investment goes in, not just to the journey itself, but all of those pieces around it, in order to make the journey the valuable experience that we need it to be.
And to this thing about structure and putting in the guardrails is really important. I think many people here will have been aware of or lived through or know about the psychedelic revolution of the 60s and flower power and like parties going crazy and LSD everywhere and like the Beatles and all this kind of stuff. That was pretty chaotic because people were just taking these drugs like recreationally in complex situations where you are slightly hostage to fortune of whatever's happening around you. Whereas now, I think what's happening in the second psychedelic renaissance or revolution is they're putting these structured therapeutic rituals around it. And what I believe here, speaking here, is that Christian ceremony is one of the most protective and safety-making structures you can put around the experience. If you pray beforehand, you call in Jesus, you call in Mary, you call in Archangel Michael, all these, you invoke them and they hold the space, you're protected, and dark things won't enter. Like, you will be safe. And I think that's why the structuring is so important, because then you don't have random stuff going on around you while you're doing it. You're taking it seriously and you're giving it an intention. And that's very different to what was happening in the 60s. And I think that's what's changing. I mean, this stuff's in stage 4 trials in America. Like, we're close for it to becoming therapeutically available. Like, that requires so much like rigor and like scientific testing, you know, just like any drug that people take. So yeah, it's close.
Yeah,
this is serious. It's not like, it's not just like a fun subject. Like, it is a fun subject. It's like the most fun ever. But it's like, it is also incredibly serious. This could heal a lot of trauma. It could heal. It could save the mental health crisis. You know, people just get given antidepressants willy-nilly, like all around the world, like just keeping them in this kind of fairly zombie-like state, not really feeling anything. And it's strange that that's the solution. It's not a solution. It's a kind of like pressing pause. It's like a holding email. It's like, it's not really taking us through. So I think we're heading towards a very big shift. And actually, where most of this leads is that people start to believe in God. You know, that's one of the most common things that happens, is you start to become more spiritual and trusting in the divine more. And like, I think most people here probably want that to happen. And this is one portal in. It's not the only portal, but it's a very powerful one for a world and a society which is really not finding its direction right now. And we need to find our direction, a good direction.
Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you, Guy. So, Guy's sort of mentioned the Christian container. I'm wondering, as you think about, as you are Muslim, and what might Islam bring to the conversation and to the experience?
I think for me, the trial that we both experienced, I know that the participants, many were Christian, quite a few Jewish siblings, and I was the only Muslim participant, and apparently they found it quite hard to recruit a Muslim person. I don't know what they tried as part of that recruitment, so I can't comment, but I was quite assertive in saying, this is great for a Christian container, or maybe even passable for an interfaith container, just taking a look at the playlist, the music that would be on throughout the whole of your journey, and you're expected to wear a headset. So the music really feels like it's going into your heart and into your sort of being. I really pushed a little bit, well, quite a bit at the beginning, and I was told, well, actually, you're one of the last people to join the study, and it's a clinical trial, so we've kind of got to give, you know, same, so we can actually have comparative data. So I understood that, but I was really disheartened and quite heartbroken, actually, that you're actively looking for Muslim participants and probably participants from other faiths, but you're not really that well equipped to hold them in the way that you might hold my Christian siblings on this in this trial. And I think there's a I think there's a huge learning curve for people who do that kind of work, whether it's in the US or the UK or elsewhere, that, you know, to sort of chuck something that's a bit tantric in the playlist does not mean to say that you've dealt with all of the East, you know. I had two amazing experiences, but I don't think that I think they could have been, I mean, they are what they were, and I'm grateful for them, and it was as it was meant to be, and I'm a big believer in that. But I do think that if we say that we want other communities to participate, then it's really important that we learn to understand what does this look like from their perspective, and that we don't just, you know, sort of nudge our Muslim friend or neighbor that we might know and say, can you just give me a song or something that, you know, helps me to engage with these other communities? I think it's got to go deeper than that. So when I've, since then, when I've held space for people taking journeys, I've asked Muslims, what do you want? Because Muslims come from all over the world, obviously. They have all sorts of idiosyncrasies. Some are practicing, as they would say, some are culturally Muslim. Others have had traumatic experience with Islam. Some are completely and utterly heart, mind, body, soul committed to Islam. It's no different to Christianity, right? Like, they come in all sorts of colors, shapes, and sizes, essentially. And so for me, the really important thing is that there is not one size fits all approach at all. If I have a playlist and I think, oh, well, that worked for two people, maybe it'll work for another five people, I think I'm shortchanging them, really. And this is such phenomenal, unique experiences. And they may only ever have one in their life. And that's a big, big responsibility when you're developing a container. So for me, the really important thing is to ask them what is their favorite music. And it may be that they happen to be Muslim, but their favorite music is, I don't know, AC/DC or something like that, right? Like, it doesn't have to be religious. If they want to have a religious experience, and then we have to be curious about what religious or music that reminds them of God or spirit or heart or something. But it's not the obvious sometimes, right? Because we're all so unique. And then most recently in the journey that I was helping lead, I recited at the request of the person taking the journey, we had a conversation about what prayers might appeal in Arabic or in any other language. And the prayers that they chose are not the prayers that I would have thought that they would choose, but they did anyway, and I knew those. And so we sat in a circle, held hands with permission, and I recited those prayers and took my time in singing, and sort of it changes. Like, the way that guy sang at the beginning when we sat down, it was just breathtaking, and it completely changes the atmosphere. So there's something about this has to be in communication, in communion, essentially. And there's also something about developing a container suitable for an individual or a group for that one time, and that's all it's valid for, that one time. And for the next person or five people later, it may be that, oh, that feels very similar to the container that I had for somebody else, but it's not exactly the same. And then the space, right? So for the space to be in keeping with that person's culture, that person's likes, dislikes, so there isn't anything in that space that will make them feel like, that's a bit strange, that's nothing to do with me, and it's taking me somewhere else. To think really carefully and critically, how do I bring myself into this space? Are there paintings? Are there patterns? Is there a rug? You know, all of these things affect your experience deeply. And then to be mindful of things like dignity, the person's body, and making sure that they feel dignified in the way that they would want, and that, you know, if they need to go to the bathroom or something, that is done in a way that is dignified for them. And I think there's something really powerful and sacred about dignity when you're vulnerable, and for you to feel safe amongst the people around you, that they will hold you in every which way, is part of that build-up, that those sessions beforehand is part of the conversation around how to build the container. We want that conversation together. We want to build the container together. But, you know, for me, when I sort of try and bring up Islam into my experience during the clinical trial, I was kind of racking my brains thinking, well, it's not the playlist and it's not my guides. And, you know, if I say something, if I say Arabic phrases or even any other language that is not English, they're not going to understand what on earth I'm talking about. And that could be like the thing that I really need to remember afterwards. And you overthink it. I overthink things to a degree. But there was something about if I had somebody in the room that was a no judgment, no expectation kind of Muslim person, I'd feel seen. And I think that for me ended up being that I had to ask everybody to leave the room before each dosing, before actually taking the plant medicine. And I, you know, made my ablutions beforehand, and I asked them to leave the room, and I did my prayers, and I prostrated to God, for me, to the divine. And I asked to be held, I asked to be kept safe, and I revised my intentions. I reminded myself by talking to God about, why am I even doing this? Like, this is crazy. What am I doing in this room? And then just reminding myself that I did the work before I got to this moment, and it felt right, and there was flow. And so I'm going to trust, and I'm going to follow that flow. So there are some aspects of a container that I think is just a good container, no matter whether you're religious or otherwise. And then there are key aspects of a container that I think come from really giving the person time, space, questions to encourage their curiosity about, what does this look like? Because it's likely that they've never had to design their own container in conjunction with you as well. So I think just lots and lots of expansion, lots and lots of space to allow them to explore what comes up for them, and therefore realize what really matters to me in this moment.
Oh, that's, thank you. Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, that's because I know one of the criticisms, the playlist, there's something called the Johns Hopkins Psychedelic Playlist, and you can find it on Spotify, so that's how available it is. So, but it is very heavy on sort of classical Christian music, mostly instrumental. But yeah, it's very Christian.
Just one thing to say, yeah. The music. My goodness, the music, how it sounds. You've never heard music like this. Yeah. I mean, if you're into music, like, I don't know what else to say, really.
I do want to leave a few minutes. I do want to leave some time for questions, but I also want to take a minute for shameless self-promotion. For all,
Do it.
Is there anything you want to share? So Ligare is our organization. It's Latin. It means to unite or to bind. It's also the root word of religion. Religion is religare, and the fact that ligare.org was available was all I needed to name the organization. We do have a stall down in the takeaway area. We're there. We have what we're calling a psychedelic confessional, which is really just a place to come talk to us. We're here all weekend, so please come. Guy?
Well, here's a book called Britain's Pilgrim Places, 600 places, the holiest, whatever that means, in Britain, and 100 routes, pilgrim routes you can do, and lots of photos, and it was made over 15 years of work. Me and my co-author, I didn't do the 15 years, he did, but and it's unbelievable. It's an amazing thing, and I can say that because I didn't totally write it. So it's called Britain's Pilgrim Places, and it connects us to nature and spirituality in the way that we've connected those two. And I did want to say, like, one of the space aspects is nature. And we're here at Greenbelt, like, the greening force of life in all nature, in everything, comes through in psychedelics. You start to really, really feel that nature is inside you. And I think that's a very, very special experience, and one that we could all do have more of in this world, because I think we've become a bit disconnected from it.
Thank you, God. And again, I'm sorry we don't have more time, but I do want to take at least the next 5 or 6 minutes for questions that you, and yes, right here, and then, yeah. Okay.
It's fascinating and very encouraging to see this going on, basically. There's many things I could ask, but one thing that comes to mind is I don't know if it's the right question, but how does this, what do you think about the Holy Spirit? How do you think about it in terms of this, in terms of this idea of psychedelics and re-engagement with the body and things? I wonder if there's any, how can it be framed in a certain way? Because it's the most mystical side of the Trinity and people have a problem with it. And I wonder if you have any insights on that.
I think it's the part of the tradition that scares the institution the most, because it's so unpredictable. And I think all of us would say, whether that was our language or not, that the experience is not going to be controlled. And to me, that's the wild goose. That's the wildness of the spirit, the unpredictability of the spirit. And to me, that's the connection.
I'd say, yeah, just this uncontrollable flow, the flow of the experience. The only time that, in my experience, the only time the psychedelic stuff goes wrong is when people try and interrupt the flow of the Holy Spirit. That's when they try and stop it with their mind for whatever reason, and they get that causes the issues. But if you surrender, just go with the flow, I think that's it's a force that you can't stop.
Yeah, right here. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks ever so much for a really, really good just talk on the whole area of religion and psychedelics. I've got lots of questions, but I guess the one that I'm thinking of at the moment is you mentioned these profound experiences you had during this study trial at Johns Hopkins. Do you also go for kind of top-ups?
yeah. Well,
My answer is really short. No. I've been offered and there have been opportunities, but not really. I mean, I feel like I'm still unpacking a lot of that, and I really resonate with the fact that it's fearful. Also, it takes a lot of energy, time, commitment to prep, to do, and then integration. Like, it's a huge commitment, and until I feel like I have no choice but to do it, I don't think I'll sort of step into it in a big way again. But who knows when that is? That could be tomorrow. It could be in 5 years' time.
I think it's Alan Watts. I think it was Alan Watts, but it was somebody in the 60s or 70s psychedelic culture that said, when you get the message, hang up the phone. So I think that's something to think about, too. There was, right over here.
Hiya. It was said earlier it could save the mental health crisis. Do you believe this is the only thing needed to save it, or should it be used in conjunction with other things like therapy and health and general exercise?
Well, I mean, the way it's being used is part of therapy. That's psychedelic assisted therapy. So, yeah, and I don't think it's the only spiritual tool. It is just it's a very effective and reliable one. But mental health needs, I mean, particularly people that are really dealing with something serious need mental health professional care. And I think, and they need community, and people. Well, all of us need community, but I think that's one of the part of the crisis we're in is people. A crisis of meaning is there's no community, or it's very lacking. So no, this is not a replacement of. And depending on the severity of the situation, people need a lot of support. And psychedelic assisted therapy it's not just people getting with. A lot of us can just get with our friends and do it. To keep our mental health and spiritual health in line, but people who are dealing with serious things need serious and professional care.
And also, one of the things about psychedelic, sort of quality of psychedelic thinking is often both and. Yeah. So that's set up as an either or. You either do psychedelics or it's not that. You start to become very flexible in your thinking. Everything can work. Breath work, yoga, like all of it. You have to anchor it, because if you just do this, you'll go. You have to anchor this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
This is going to be our last question, okay. But you've heard Hunt's invitation to go to Ligari and continue these conversations. Remember that the pastoral team and the wellbeing team are around and about the venue.
Hi. You mentioned that without careful preparation, you use the phrase you can get stuck. I'm just wondering what you mean by that. What does getting stuck mean?
I think for me, when I was talking about that, if I can lean on your example, Hunt, about the electric current running from the bottom of the spine to the Adam's apple, and I think if the story had ended there, that for me would have been getting stuck. Like that was the totality of your experience, but it wasn't meant to go any further. And I think the fact that he had guides who were able to help him move through that means that there was an even greater story, message, learning, journey in that moment, in that experience, rather than sort of stopping at the throat.
Yeah, that just speaks to the preparation of the facilitator, which is very important. It's critically important. That's such a good example.
When we were being prepared, one of the things that I kept hearing from the scientists in the clinical trial is that, you know, because I'd never heard of psychedelics before. I had no idea, and I was encouraged not to read and not to understand it, so I could have unique an experience as possible. And so, and I stayed true to that, so I didn't go in with any expectations, but I did keep hearing that, you know, wonderful things might happen, but also if you see something that feels fearful, that feels like you don't want to go in its direction, don't run in the opposite direction, in and through, move in and through. And I just had cartoon like images in my head thinking, what must that mean? But yeah, I think there's something about if you're running the other direction, it could yeah, running towards is a better experience than running away. Running towards those fears and moving through them.
Thank you so much. Can we have a huge pagoda? Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts. for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.